Iowa's baseball diamonds are buried beneath several inches of freshly fallen snow right now, but today we're going to play some old-fashioned ball and go back in time to when baseball was new. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, when Iowa met baseball, I'll talk with Iowa baseball historian John Liapa about how baseball came to Iowa. We'll explore the history, the myths, and talk about the players. We'll also talk about an unusual collection of baseballs on display at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum as part of the Signature of Baseball exhibit. Over 180 balls signed by world leaders, including Mikhail Gorbachev. Join the conversation after the news. It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. Good morning. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're going to go back in time to when Iowa met baseball. And a little later in the hour, we'll talk about the Signature of Baseball exhibit now on display at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, including an unusual collection of baseballs, over 180 balls signed by world leaders. But with me right now is Iowa baseball historian John Liapa. He's an emeritus professor of history and political science at Des Moines Area Community College. Hello, John.
Good morning, Charity.
Thank you so much for being here today.
Well, thank you.
Now, when is the first record that we have of baseball being played in Iowa?
Well, the earliest record that we've been able to find is by reading some of the early newspapers. And there's kind of a common sense to it. The pattern of settlement of Iowa basically was from the southeast to the northwest along the river valleys. So when you're looking for that information, it made sense to look in some of the papers of the first towns that were settled. And the earliest reference we've found is in May of 1858. There was a club organized in Davenport called the Pastime Baseball Club. And it did include some of the officers were some of the founders of the city of Davenport. There's very little mention of the game of baseball prior to the Civil War. We found some records in Dubuque, which again makes some sense. It's Iowa's oldest community and so on. Usually things like baseball, they followed commerce. And as Iowa was developing in its early days as a state, it became a state in 1846. It makes sense that people who had traveled out east had brought knowledge of the game of baseball back to Iowa with them. And it caught on, you know, fairly slowly before the Civil War. There are very few clubs, very few teams, and very few accounts of games being played. But the Civil War played a tremendous role as kind of a catalyst for the spread of the game.
In what way?
Well, a lot of the young Iowans, Iowa contributed 78,000 soldiers to the war, and on a per capita basis, one of the highest percentages of any of the Union states. And a lot of these kids, when they went off to war, officers were oftentimes elected, and a lot of those officers were people who had more formal education. They might have been doctors or lawyers, and which, of course, had allowed them to travel. A lot of them had been to New Orleans. A lot of them had traveled to Cincinnati or St. Louis. And those are places where baseball was played before it was played here in Iowa. And so a lot of times, you know, as these young kids went off to war, if you study the war and so on, most people are familiar with the great battles at Antietam or Shiloh or Vicksburg, but what they're not aware of is that there were great lulls, long periods of time in between the major battles, and there was a lot of tedium, a lot of extra time. And if you start reading the diaries of some of the soldiers, including a lot of the Iowa kids, there are references made to the game of baseball being played. There's this a wonderful chromolithograph, a picture of a prisoner of war camp in Salisbury, North Carolina. And what the picture shows, it shows Confederate guards standing around, and they're watching as Union prisoners are playing the game of baseball. There's very little mention of baseball in the South prior to the Civil War, except in places like New Orleans. And so for the first time, a lot of these Southerners were being introduced to the game of baseball. When the war, if you think about some of the skills that are required to be successful militarily, you've got to practice and you've got to drill, and the emphasis is on teamwork as opposed to the individual. A lot of those characteristics carry over to success as a sports team, or in this case, a baseball team. So when those young kids came back home in 1865, when the war ended, a lot of them came back with at least a rudimentary kind of a knowledge of the game of baseball. And there's one astounding statistic when you look at the year 1866. There are only 10 or fewer baseball clubs in Iowa, including one in Des Moines called the Capital Cities. The next year, in 1867, there are over 200 baseball clubs in the state of Iowa. So it literally exploded after the Civil War.
Wow. And I think we should go back and refresh ourselves on a little bit of baseball history, because a lot of us grew up believing that Abner Doubleday invented baseball. That's not true. And there were actually several different iterations of baseball that were being played in the early years. So give us a little bit of a history and tell us where the game that was played in Iowa came from.
Okay. Well, you're absolutely right. The myth is that Abner Doubleday, who was a great American, and he was a highly decorated officer in the Civil War. He was there when the war started. He fired some of the shots at Fort Sumter and so on. But the myth is that in 1839, in Cooperstown, New York, that Abner Doubleday called together boys from two of the local schools there, and on the shores of Lake Otsego, that he took a stick and drew a diamond in the sand. And then the boys basically played under rules that he outlined, which included set positions and nine innings and three outs per inning and so on. The problem with that is that Abner Doubleday in 1839 was a sophomore at West Point Military Academy. And the military academies, not in 1839, not today, they don't give you the summer to go off and invent baseball. And there are accurate records of his being at West Point when he supposedly was in Cooperstown, New York, inventing baseball. And the other part of, you know, important fact dispelling that is that Doubleday, when he died, he left an incredible amount of diary information. There are, I think, some 70 volumes of diaries in the family. And as you go through the diaries, you'd think somewhere in volume 23, chapter 14, there might be some mention that I took the summer off to invent baseball. There's no mention whatsoever of his having invented baseball. So where did the game come from? No one invented baseball. Baseball evolved. It evolved out of a lot of games that were much, much older, and children's games, games that were called rounders and town ball and stool ball and one cat. There are references by soldiers at Valley Forge with George Washington of playing something called baseball. And sometimes it's one word. They simply call it base. Sometimes they simply call it ball. Sometimes it's hyphenated. There is a city ordinance in Pittsfield, Massachusetts in the 1790s that was passed banning the playing of baseball within a certain number of feet of public buildings because they were breaking too many windows. So the game goes back to a lot of children's games. You can look back in the 1740s rules of children's games. There was something called stool ball or, again, rounders, where kids would swat at a round object with either a paddle or a branch, and then they would run to set positions. Early on, there were different rules. There were Massachusetts rules in the New England area, which involved, instead of three bases, it involved four bases. It was more square-shaped instead of diamond-shaped. There were no foul lines. The number of players was indefinite on the field. You could have 8 or 9. You could have 23. There were different ways of getting people out. You could get them out on the bounce, or you could get them out on the fly. Or another, there's a term called plugging or soaking. When the base runner was running from base to base, you could actually throw at the runner, and if you hit him, he was out. There were also rules, in addition to the Massachusetts rules, there were Philadelphia rules that go back to the 1830s, which were a little bit different. And then finally, in the 1840s, in New York City, there was a club called the New York Knickerbockers, and there are a number of people that played on that team that helped put together something that approximates the rules that we're familiar with today. And so by the time that Iowa was introduced to the game, the New York rules were winning out over the other, you know, different rules that were being played. And, of course, those were the rules that a lot of people took that knowledge to the Civil War with and eventually found their way to Iowa. So by the time this club is organized in Davenport, the New York rules, which do approximate, you know, today's game somewhat anyway, were winning out over the other games. And, you know, it found its way here to the state. So.
All right. Well, and you mentioned the explosion of popularity between 1866 and 1867. Not everybody played baseball. Not everybody was on board with this explosion. What were some of the reactions that people who weren't into the game had to this obsession with baseball?
Well, I think it was, you know, kind of it took a lot of people by surprise. When you came out here to Homestead in Iowa, the priorities in a community were that you, first of all, took care of your family by building a home. And then, you know, the priority was to build a church and to build a school. But after the Civil War, one of the other priorities is that if you put together a baseball team, that puts your community on the map. And there were small towns here in Iowa, less than 5,000 people, like Keokuk, that would have three baseball teams by the 1870s. And if you look at some of the first players and some of the first uniforms, it was truly a badge of honor to play on that first select nine team representing your community. There are some wonderful team pictures of a team from Marshall County, which shows, you know, the Marshall Baseball Club. And again, very attractive uniforms. So the community... it was important for them to have a club representing them. They're actually playing tournaments by the end of 1866. There's a very detailed account of two clubs, one from Fort Dodge and one from Marshalltown, that they both had decided they were the best club in the state. So they were going to play a game to decide who truly was the best club. So they would meet at a neutral site in October of 1866 in Boonesboro, which today is Boone. And there a long, long, detailed account of that game. But it does
so our little mini World Series.
It was, yeah. And what's interesting about that is the two teams, as they arrived for the game, there were parades, there were receptions for them. It wasn't just a baseball game. It was a weekend of activity. There was a formal dinner. There was a dance and so on. It was a big deal for these little communities to have a baseball team, and especially, you know, as it became more competitive, to have a good baseball team.
And who won that game?
Fort Dodge won that game. It was a close game. But, you know, remember then the game was different, too. You didn't have any gloves, and you didn't have any catcher's masks. The scores were high. The games oftentimes ran as long as maybe 5 hours. It was not unusual to have games with a score of something like 130 to 110. So it was a very different game. Gloves aren't introduced till the 1870s. The mask was introduced at Harvard University towards the end of the 1870s, the early 1880s. And that would start to change the game. And again, remember, these were amateur teams at that time. So it was free and open to the general public. And it was a place for people to socialize and gather a lot of time on Sundays after people went to church in their, you know, best Sunday dress. They would go right from church to watch their local baseball team play.
We're going to take a short break. We'll be back in just a moment. I'm talking with Iowa baseball historian John Liapa. We are talking about when Iowa met baseball. We'll continue in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
Little boy in a baseball hat stands in the field with his ball and bat. Says, I am the greatest player of them all. Puts his bat on his shoulder and he tosses up his ball. And the ball goes up and the ball comes down, swings his bat all the way around. The world's so still you can hear the sound. The baseball falls to the ground.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about baseball. We've gone back to the very beginning of baseball in the state of Iowa. It became very popular right after the Civil War. Coming up in a few minutes, we'll talk about a display or an exhibit on display right now, the signature of baseball at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch, on display through March 22nd. With me right now is Iowa baseball historian John Liapa. And John, just before the break, we talked briefly about some of the ways that the game was very different in the 1860s and even into the 1870s. One of the big differences was that there were no gloves. And that was something that really marked a lot of the players. Tell me about the hands of the great baseball players in Iowa in the 1860s.
Well, when I do my presentations, I oftentimes address as a young 18-year-old from Montrose, Iowa, which is down by Keokuk, His name was Calvin McVeigh, and he was Iowa's first professional player, baseball player. He would be signed on by George and Harry Wright to play for the 1869 Cincinnati Red Stockings at $800 a year. But he was a very talented all-around athlete, and he played every position when he started playing baseball. And there were some incredible descriptions of when he got through playing some of these games that went on for 4 or 5 hours. It was almost a badge of honor to have hands that were bloodied, and they referred to them sometimes as ham hocks and broken fingers and knuckles, and they were black and blue. And it was the manly thing to do. You didn't wear gloves because that sort of helped define you as a wonderful, you know, as a great athlete and so on. When the first gloves were introduced, they looked nothing like the gloves that we see today. They looked sort of like a golf glove today, you know, just fingers.
You could still break a finger.
Oh, easily, yeah. But see, one other difference was is that you didn't have pitching the way it is today. First of all, the distance from the mound was 45 feet instead of the 60 feet that we have today. And it wasn't called, he wasn't called a pitcher. He was called a feeder. And, you know, you weren't called a batter. You were called a striker. And the person that was batting could actually ask whether he wanted the ball in high or if he wanted the ball, you know, in low. And that's one of the reasons that you'll see the focus was on batting, not on pitching. Your job was to deliver the ball to the batter. And that's one of the reasons you'll see the real high scores. You won't see a lot of home runs because the balls back in the 1870s and 80s were much softer than the balls are today. They were designed slightly differently. One style it was referred to as the lemon peel ball, and when you look at them, you can see that's it looked like, you know, a lemon with the segments and so on. But the game was a different kind of a game, and like I said, up until probably the mid-1870s, their Harper's Weekly was one of the first publications to depict some of the views of early baseball games being played. And when you look at some of these, you can almost immediately pin down the decade by what the uniforms look like and what the equipment was that was being used. And there's a wonderful picture of a game being played with a big pavilion in the background with red, white, and blue bunting. But the first thing you notice is that none of the players have gloves, so that helps date that right away. But that's just basically part of that early game. And gloves would come in gradually as the game, you know, started changing and became more professional, and the players, their skill levels went up and so on. And you see pretty much gloves prevalent throughout the game by the 1880s and 1890s.
How about, we were talking about face masks. Did we see a lot of black eyes and concussions and broken teeth?
You did. But one other difference, too, is that the catcher was not situated the way he is today. He was not, you know, right behind home plate. Oftentimes, the catcher would be back 15 feet, and the umpire would not be directly behind the catcher. He would be off to the side a little bit. So you did see that, but it was a different game, and it would gradually, you know, evolve and change. The catcher would get more equipment. There was a gentleman named Fred Thayer who used, you know, the first mask, like I said, at Harvard. And gradually, as the game, you know, the emphasis was on faster pitching, and you'd see the necessity for the mask come into the game. So,
now with Iowa loving baseball so much, I mean, we have a couple of great minor league teams in the state of Iowa. Why do you think we never developed a major league team?
We actually did. And when I say that, in the 1870s, the first team that Iowa ever had that was all professional, and it's not major league that, in the way that we think of it today, but it was something called the American Association, which was a predecessor to the National League. The National League was started in 1876. And the team, it was called the Keokuk Westerns, and they were put together in 1875. And their season was short. And basically, to answer your question, Keokuk at the time was on the fringe of the frontier. And one of the reasons their season was short, their record was 1-12. And there's a funny account of some of those last games. They were scheduled to play a team that was here from Boston. And, of course, Boston had some of the best players in the country. And they played the first game, and Boston won by a lopsided margin in front of a very small gate. The point was that they weren't making much money by coming to Keokuk, Iowa, to play. And what happened is they were supposed to play that second game the next day, And the Boston team basically skipped in the middle of the night out of their hotel and basically got out of Keokuk and went back to Chicago. And they forfeit the game because they didn't want to play. And shortly after that, Keokuk had to cancel its team, cancel its season. So that's Iowa's first venture into professional baseball. You don't see the major leagues as we know them until the following year in 1876. And when the National League was organized that year, again, an Iowan, Cap Anson of Marshalltown, was one of the key players on that the Chicago White Stocking team that was part of the first National League.
We're going to continue talking about baseball history, and John, I want you to stay with us. I'm talking with Iowa baseball historian John Liapa, but we're going to broaden the conversation now. The Signature of Baseball is an exhibit that's on display right now at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch through March 22nd. It celebrates President Hoover's love of baseball and features some of his baseball memorabilia, as well as an unusual collection of baseballs put together by Randy Kaplan, 180 balls signed by world leaders, including Nelson Mandela, Margaret Thatcher. Randy Kaplan is on the line with us now. He's a governmental affairs specialist in New York. He's been collecting baseballs since 1996, or at least this collection of baseballs since 1996. Hi, Randy.
Hi, good morning, Charity. How are you?
Good. Thank you so much for being here today.
Thank you. John, I have to tell you, I just got a lesson in baseball history. That was incredible.
Thank you, Randy.
Melanie Wire is also here. She's the assistant curator and exhibit specialist at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum. Hello, Melanie.
Hello.
Thank you so much for being here today. And Randy, let's talk about this collection. How did this get started for you?
As a kid, I was a collector of almost everything you can imagine, baseball cards, comic books. As I got older, I met a lot of the rock stars and the movie stars and the sports figures, and I was getting autographs selectively. And then in 1993, I was at the Hall of Fame in Cooperstown, and I saw this incredible display of opening day pitches that were thrown out by presidents. And I said to myself, what an incredible concept. What better way to bring diplomacy from around the world through baseball? Everybody knows that baseball represents America. And a couple of years later, I was at a meeting with President Clinton in 1996, and I was lucky enough to meet him while he was the sitting president, and he was the first person that signed a baseball for my collection. And at that point, moving forward, I decided I was going to collect heads of state and world leaders on signed baseballs. And here we are a bunch of years later, and the collection's growing, and I'm thrilled to be able to share it with the folks at the Hoover Museum.
So how did you go about meeting all of these heads of state?
Well, it's a lot of work. It's a lot of trying to figure out where folks are going to be. The criteria I decided to use from the very beginning was that if I didn't meet somebody on my own, I would go ahead and use a relationship that I have. But I was very lucky, and I've met people like Mikhail Gorbachev over the years. You mentioned Margaret Thatcher. Congressman Greg Meeks back in 2005 was able to get Nelson Mandela to sign a baseball for me when he came to visit at the Black Congressional Caucus meeting in Washington, D.C., and I was thrilled when he called me and told me that he was able to get the Mandiba to sign it.
Now, as you say, baseball is a symbol of the United States of America in some ways. It's not a global sport. Have you ever presented a world leader with a baseball and had them not know what it was?
Yeah, I probably have 40 or 50 of them that they had no clue what it was when they were signing it. And they just, you know, they may understand in hindsight, in retrospect, looking back, oh yeah, that's baseball, the American game. But so many of them look confused, and it's just a wonderful feeling, and it's a great rush to be able to get a head of state to sign a baseball. You mentioned Mikhail Gorbachev. I was lucky enough to meet him back in 1996. He was doing a really rare book signing here in New York City. And at the time, I had gotten there at about 2-3 o'clock in the morning, waited online. I knew I'd be able to meet him. Getting a baseball signed was another story, though. Everybody was going to be receiving a signed book if you got there by a certain time in the morning. I think it was limited to 100 people who were guaranteed signed books. I called my landlord at the time, who spoke fluent Russian, and I said, look, I need a favor. I'm going to be meeting Mr. Gorbachev tomorrow morning. I need you to help me learn a passage so I can recite this to him. It'll aid me in trying to get my baseball signed. And sure enough, when it was my turn to get up in line, security had pushed me away when I reached out with the baseball, and I simultaneously recited this passage that I had memorized phonetically, of course. And Mr. Gorbachev took the ball, pushed the security folks away, signed the ball, sat back down, presented it to me, and I was thrilled. It was one of those moments that I'll never forget.
Wow. Now, in the newsroom this morning, we were talking about your collection, and I have a really hard time imagining walking up to Margaret Thatcher and asking her to sign a baseball. Did you get her to sign that in person?
I did, actually. I was lucky enough to meet Margaret Thatcher a couple of occasions. One of them was when she was at Hofstra University here on Long Island for a presidential, the Margaret Thatcher conference back in the year 2000, I believe it was. And she was just being honored, and this was pre-9/11, so there was a lot less security, as you can imagine. And I was in a couple of the events where she was present, and I was right next to her, and she gladly obliged.
Did she know what baseball was?
Oh, she absolutely did. Her and Ronald Reagan were tremendous friends, and I'm sure he probably took her to a game or two.
So as this collection grew, what did you think you would do with it?
From day one, I knew exactly what I wanted to do with it, okay? I wanted to share this with the world. And as a collector and somebody who's a presidential and historical buff, I figured what better way to share it with the public than to do it through the NARA system, the National Archives. So I've started to get it into exhibits throughout the country. And my first exhibit was at the Gerald Ford Presidential Museum in Grand Rapids. And that was part of a larger collection. And that was in 2008. And then in 2012, I was able to use some of my contacts with the Clinton folks, and I was able to get part of my collection on exhibit there for a huge display they did on baseball as well. And then a part of my collection went to the Richard Nixon Museum this past summer. And simultaneously, I had about 125 baseballs on exhibit for the last 9 or 10 months prior to the Hoover Museum at the LBJ Museum in Austin, Texas. And that was a lot of fun. But I have to say the Herbert Hoover one by far is the best exhibit. Melanie and Tom Schwartz and the team over at the museum did an incredible job putting this together. My jaw dropped when I walked in and I saw the wonderful exhibit. So I hope that everybody does get a chance to get there and view this because it's my passion and I want to be able to share it with so many others.
And are you still collecting?
Absolutely. It never stops. It's a 24-hour day, 7-day-a-week job. Always doing research, always carrying baseballs, always meeting and fostering relationships with ambassadors. Just last month in New York City, I was thrilled. The ambassador of India called me up, the consul general, Ambassador Malloy, and he was kind enough to get me Narendra Modi, the sitting prime minister of India, to sign a baseball for my collection. And they did a presentation for me in Manhattan. It was wonderful.
Are there people that are on your dream list?
Absolutely. Anybody who tells you they're a collector and doesn't have that list, they're kidding you. For years and years, it's been, whether you love them or hate them, Vladimir Putin, any of the Chinese leaders. The Chinese folks have been evading me for years. I have not been able to get them. However, and I'm hoping this reaches the right people, I am aware that the Iowa governor is very, very good friends with the Chinese premier. And a friend of mine who knows the governor well is going to see if there's any chance on his next meeting with the Chinese leader that he can kindly have a ball signed for me.
All right.
So we're keeping our fingers crossed on that one. And anyone who wants to help me lobby on that behalf for the governor's office, please to come through for me. John Bertrand Aristide, Dmitry Medvedev, Nicolas Sarkozy has been hard for me to get. I am trying right now. This is about my 10th try to get him. So I'll keep you all posted. I can tell you that I was turned down by a few people. It's not an easy thing to do, as you can imagine, to approach a world leader in person, even with some connections and even with gaining some access. Junichiro Koizumi was 2 feet in front of me, the former prime minister of Japan. At the time, he was the sitting prime minister. And I tried to say a couple of passages in Japanese, and I even related to the fact that he was a big Elvis Presley fan, which I know he is, and he just wouldn't do it. Prince Charles was within a couple of, I'd say about 10 feet, 15 feet, at a function here in Harlem in New York City many years ago. State Department just would not let him come closer than that to me, unfortunately. And Jalal Talabani, the former Iraqi president up until 2014, walked right by me at an event in New York City during UN week, Unfortunately, he was walking with crutches, so he didn't have mobility with his hands. Otherwise, I think I would have been able to get him to sign, and that would have been a wonderful one.
So if somebody turns you down, do you give up?
Never. There's no such thing. I can't even begin to tell you how many times. My wife got the phone bill one time, and she was screaming at me because I was calling South Korea years ago. So many times, it took me about a year of planning and phone calls to finally get Kim Dae-young to sign a baseball for me. After many, many no's, I'm sorry, he can't do this for you. And really, what I think about it, this is diplomacy through baseball. Many of the ambassadors have become wonderful acquaintances of mine and have helped me get some of the signatures that I otherwise would not have been able to.
Do you travel on purpose to get these signatures?
There are times when I've gotten on a plane and I'll go someplace if I know there's going to be an event, absolutely. But I have to tell you, living in New York, and
a lot of leaders come to you.
Correct. Not only just during UN week, but other functions throughout the year. And I have a great friend of mine in Washington, D.C., who is a fellow collector, and he's been wonderful. He's helped me procure signatures from folks that I haven't been able to meet in person where he has. So the collecting world is funny. People help each other out. They want to help you succeed. Ambassadors want to come on board and help you try and acquire these balls. They understand the importance of it. It's taken on a life of its own. I have 200 baseballs right now signed by world leaders and heads of state, and it never ends. It just never ends.
We're going to take a short break here, Randy. Randy Kaplan is on the line. We're talking about his collection of baseballs, which is on display right now at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum. Melanie Weyer is also here from the museum, and John Liapa, Iowa baseball historian. We'll continue this conversation in a moment. This is Talk of Iowa.
They call this thing a sport. I think if it were slower, it'd be farming, not more. Why waste your time with baseball? Play games that make more sense.
You just don't know the thrill. I love hitting high above the fence. Get out your glove and bat, it's high time to play the American pastime. Come on, get going, it's the right kind of day for a baseball game.
The rules are pretty simple, the pitcher throws the ball, the batter tries to hit it far and hard, but that's not all, cause then he goes for bases.
The fielders run about, and then there's lots of other rules, you'll figure it.
It's Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio. I'm Charity Nebbe. This hour, we're talking about baseball. We've been going back deep into the history of baseball in the state of Iowa with Iowa baseball historian John Liapa. Also, there is an exhibit on display right now, The Signature of Baseball, at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Library and Museum in West Branch through March 22nd. We've been talking with Randy Kaplan. He is a governmental affairs specialist in New York, and he's been collecting baseballs signed by world leaders since 1996. He has over 180 balls signed by world leaders like Nelson Mandela, Mikhail Gorbachev, Margaret Thatcher, and many others. Melanie Weyer is also here. She's the assistant curator and exhibit specialist at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum. And Melanie, I know these baseballs from Randy are not the only thing in your exhibit, and the exhibit celebrates Herbert Hoover's love for baseball. Was he a big baseball fan?
Right. Yes, he was. He was pretty much given season passes every single year. So with his collection, we have passes that start in about the 20s and go clear to the 60s. And then there's other awards and correspondence he would write to different players or coaches to congratulate them. And then we have a huge collection of photographs, so we picked out a few of the big ones with him and Babe Ruth and different monumental games. And then we also have a section on first pitches and the different presidents over the years that have thrown out first pitches.
When did that start being a thing? You know,
I don't remember. Yeah,
that's fascinating though, because I'm most recent presidents have done it
mm-hmm,
for sure.
Mm-hmm. Yep. And then with we have Randy's collection, and then we also contacted the Hoover family to see if they had any more Hoover memorabilia, and so we were able to get a baseball that was signed by Babe Ruth that was given to Hoover's granddaughter.
Wow.
So that's a unique item. And then we also have a ball that is signed by Hoover and a bunch of other players that we think is from like the late 50s old timers game that he attended. So everyone there just kind of signed the ball. So it's a unique piece. And then also we wanted to touch on Iowa baseball history, but there's no way we could tell the whole story. So we partnered with the Colonels and we were able to construct a timeline of the Colonels' history. And then we spotlighted a few of their players and were able to get signed items from them to put on display. So like a few of those, we have Belden Hill, Cliff Mapes, Art Pennington, Bruce Kim, Byron Buxton. So, I mean, and not all of the players that we spotlighted specifically played for the Colonels, but they had some kind of involvement in Cedar Rapids.
So. Interesting. Mm-hmm. So did Herbert Hoover have a particular team that was his team?
Well, it seems that he favored the Yankees, but then again, he lived in New York for so long after the presidency. But you can tell that he was a fan of just baseball, you know. So any game he could attend or watch, he was pleased.
The baseball is significantly smaller than the Hoover ball, but he still enjoyed the game.
Yep.
Well, we have a caller on the line who has a question for you, Randy, and you are welcome to join our conversation at 866-780-9100 with questions about the history of baseball in Iowa, stories that you'd like to share as well, 866-780-9100. You can tweet us at IPR Talk. You can also send email to talkofiowa@iowapublicradio.org. John Liapa is still here, Iowa baseball historian. Randy Kaplan with this remarkable collection of baseballs signed by world leaders. And Melanie Weyer, the assistant curator and exhibit specialist at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum. And Kim is on the line from Des Moines. Hi, Kim.
Howdy, and I'm trying to remember names. John, I really enjoyed your story. Randy, I'm just amazed at your collection, and I've got a question for Charity about that. Charity, I loved your interview with him, but you missed an obvious question, I thought, when he was talking about getting Gorbachev's autograph. What did you say to him? How did you get him to sign that ball?
That's a great question. What I did is I learned phonetically the night before, as I had mentioned from my landlord at the time, it's an honor to meet you. Would you please sign this for my collection of autographs? And if you asked me to recite what I recited back then now, I would have to somewhere defer back to the original piece of paper, the slip of paper where I wrote it down and memorized it back in 96. And it worked. I mean, it was just having another ace up your sleeve. Autograph collecting is one of those great endeavors where you need to think four steps ahead, five steps ahead. It's like a game of chess. You need to have something up your sleeve where you have increasing your chances of getting it signed.
Wow.
That's a great question, though.
Well, thanks. I feel a lot better now knowing the answer. But now I need to know: Are you going to tell us the hours of the Hoover library so we can come and visit this stuff?
All right, Melanie.
The museum is open 9 to 5, 7 days a week.
All right, and this display again is on through March 22nd. So
correct.
You've got just a little under a month to get there. And John, here's a question for you from email. This is from David. He says, it would be good to mention a 20th century Iowa baseball pioneer, Gene Baker. Ernie Banks died recently and has rightly received much acclaim. However, Gene Baker was actually the first black ball player signed by the Chicago Cubs. Even though Ernie was the first to play a game for them, Baker and Banks formed the first major league double play combination. Baker was the first black player on a Des Moines team. He's also given credit as the first black manager in organized baseball. To my knowledge, he's the only Iowa-born African-American to play in the old Negro Leagues with the Kansas City Monarchs as well as in the major leagues. He's largely forgotten in Des Moines, although his hometown of Davenport has done a much better job of giving him his due credit. Can you tell us a little bit more about that? That tells us something. But, John, what do you know about Gene Baker?
Yeah, no, that's absolutely right. The caller gave you a lot of the key information. Gene broke in the mid-1950s when Ernie Banks, and Gene was discovered by one of the seven Iowans in the Hall of Fame as a gentleman named J.L. Wilkinson. And he was inducted into the Hall of Fame in 2006, along with about 20 other Negro Leaguers. But the interesting thing about Wilkinson is that Wilkinson was not a baseball player, and he wasn't black. He was the man that was responsible for putting together the Kansas City Monarchs. And I think a lot of people are well aware that players like Satchel Paige and players like Ernie Banks, Willie Mays, a lot of others, first played in the Negro Leagues that were started in the 1920s. And Baker was one of those that was discovered by J.L. Wilkinson. Wilkinson was a tremendous promoter of baseball. And long before it was sort of fashionable, he would put together barnstorming teams that would travel around the country. And it was just a way to promote and market baseball. And one of the interesting teams he put together, it was called the All Nations Team, where he had players from about six different countries on the team, including a woman that played first base. But Wilkinson, a lot of the black talent that eventually went on to be the great stars of the 1950s and 60s, like Gene Baker, were discovered by Wilkinson. So the caller's absolutely right that he was overshadowed by Ernie Banks. But in the mid-1950s, I think his first image on a baseball card appears in the 1956 top set. And to this day, he still is the only Iowa major African-American major leaguer. So.
Earlier, we were talking about Iowa's first professional baseball player, and that dates back to 1869. Of course, that's pre-radio coverage. How did people follow Major League Baseball back then?
Well, I think it was promoted a lot through the newspapers. When I found a lot of this information, I basically spent hundreds of hours reading microfilm of newspapers from the 1850s. And I had mentioned earlier that first all-professional team from Keokuk. And as I went through some of that microfilm, there were advertisements in the Keokuk Gate City, the newspaper at the time, promoting some of these first teams. And then also another way to do it was with broadsides. The University of Iowa, or the State Historical Society in Iowa City, they have a wonderful broadside, which is promoting a game between two teams in southern Iowa. I think it was Corydon was one of the teams involved and so on. But as I said earlier in the hour, this was a big deal for these communities. And they, once these games were scheduled, it was something that everybody in town looked forward to, you know, when that game would be played on either a Saturday or a Sunday.
Dennis is on the line in La Crosse, Wisconsin at 866-780-9100. Hi, Dennis.
Yes, this is Dennis.
Hi, what would you like to talk about?
Well, my dad told me an interesting story. It happened in about 1935. A batter from Wadena, Iowa, in a game at West Union, Iowa, in Fayette County, was up to bat, and the University of Iowa had a graduate who was pitching for the other team. It was Dr. Belding of Wacoma. He could throw pretty hard, and he accidentally hit the batter, Homer Kuhn, in the chest. And since he was hit by a pitch, the batter trotted down to first base. But the pitch had stopped his heart, and he lay down on the bag and died. And it was a big shock to everyone. It was a big funeral, of course. People came from all over Iowa to pay honor to this accidental death. And I asked my dad's teammate about it, and my dad's teammate, Nick Kreutz, told me the same story. My dad was Leo Kinnon, who played for the St. Lucas Pirates from 1924 to 1946. My mother also told me about one of his exploits. St. Lucas was leading the league, and Guttenberg was also leading their league. So they paired the two off in a county fair at West Union. And my dad was just a small farm boy, 145 pounds or so. And the adrenaline was pumping. And one of the first pitches, he hit over the stage in center field. They had set up a stage in center field for the juggling act, for the music and whatever went on at a county fair. And it was probably the only home run he ever hit. But he batted leadoff for 10 years, so he was a fast runner and good bunter, and he could put the bat on the ball, but he did not hit many home runs.
Oh, Dennis, thank you so much for sharing your history with us today. And John, are those stories you've heard before?
Not that particular story, no. But I think there are, you know, a lot of similar stories of individual, you know, tremendous achievements by players and so on. A lot of pioneers, and I think the person that brought up the stories about Gene Baker, you know, gave a perfectly good example of sort of a pioneer here in Iowa.
All right. Well, it also reinforces the danger of the sport in the early days. I mean, obviously, bad things can still happen to baseball players today, but that's pretty terrifying. I want to ask you, Melanie, you talked about looking into the history of the Cedar Rapids Colonels, which, of course, is one of the minor league teams in the state. In looking into the history of the Colonels, what are some of the things that you found that were really surprising to you or interesting?
Well, just the extensive history that the Colonels have. They have a great baseball Hall of Fame over there that I recommend everyone to check out. But the number of times that they switched names, you know, they were the Bunnies, they were the Pirates, they were the Reds, they were the Raiders. I mean, so it's just interesting how, you know, baseball has evolved over the years. And then when you zero in and look at one team and how they've changed, it's just really fascinating. And the kinds of players that have come out of the game and how the way the players are judged is changed and the accomplishments that they have had or have, how they compare. So
fascinating. Well, and, you know, John, of course, players come from all over the place now and travel to different teams after they play here in Iowa. We've done programs in the past on really the global connections we make in Iowa because of our minor league teams in the state. Back in the early days of minor league baseball and major league baseball, did we have a much stronger connection with Iowa players going to, say, Chicago or going to the Twin Cities?
Well, I think a lot of the players. Oh, I'm sorry. There have been, you know, it's 220 Iowans have made it to the major leagues. And when I say made it to the major leagues, if you have one at bat or you have thrown one pitch, you're a major league player. And that's really the aspiration of anyone that plays in the minor leagues, is you want to make it to the bigs. Seven are enshrined in the Hall of Fame. That doesn't happen very often. But if you look at the other side of that, of those 220, there are 41 whose careers consisted of less than 10 games. And there's a wonderful expression that goes back to the 19th century that those that had a career of 10 or fewer games, they stopped in for a cup of coffee. And there are some kind of sometimes hilarious, but not to the player that was affected, accounts of a pet player that maybe had one at bat, and because of the excitement and the adrenaline and so on, at that one at bat, he swung so hard that he pulled out a muscle or something in the back, and that was the end of his major league career. But I think it's also interesting that some of these guys that had very, very short careers in the major leagues, they maybe would play for 15 or 20 years on minor league teams. There's a terrific story about Cy Slapnick. Cy was a major league scout, and he's the one that discovered Bob Feller, and he discovered a number of other Iowans, over 30 major league players, Roger Maris and so on. But Cy's major league career consisted of 10 games, three games in 1911 and seven games in 1918. But then he went on for almost 50 years to be involved with baseball as a minor league player, where he put up some pretty good statistics, especially for about 7 years in Milwaukee. And then after that, a long, long career as a scout. And the account of how he discovered Feller is fascinating, because he had to work with Feller's dad. Feller was still a minor in high school when they discovered him. And when Feller finally signed that contract, it was a contract for $1 plus an autographed baseball. Randy would enjoy this. And that's basically Feller's dad had to sign it, and he agreed to go to play at Fargo-Moorhead. But there was really no intent on the part of Cy Slapnick to have him go to Fargo-Moorhead. He was just too good. They wanted him immediately to go to Cleveland. And, of course, as a young kid still in high school, he would start his career pitching and then eventually, of course, end up in the Hall of Fame. So,
wow. Well, John, thank you so much for sharing the stories of Iowa's history with baseball with us today.
Thank you, Charity.
John Liapa is an emeritus professor of history and political science at Des Moines Area Community College. He is also a baseball historian. Randy Kaplan, thank you so much.
It was an honor to be a part of this conversation. I can't even begin to tell you how much I learned from John today.
Randy Kaplan has a remarkable collection of baseballs that is on display right now at the Herbert Hoover Museum and Library. Melanie Weyer, thank you.
Thank you.
Melanie Weyer is the assistant curator and exhibit specialist at the Herbert Hoover Presidential Museum, and the Signature of Baseball exhibit is on display through March 22nd. This is Talk of Iowa from Iowa Public Radio.
The ball game, sung by Edward Meeker, Edison Records. Katie Casey was baseball mad, had the fever and had it bad, just to root for the hometown crew, every Sioux. Katie Blue, on a Saturday, her young beau called to see if she'd like to go to see a show, but Miss Katie.